Hi, Sarah Kanoski here. I recently sat down for a conversation with the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern. We talked about her upbringing as a good Mormon girl, her unusual path into political leadership, and how she navigated some of the most terrible events in the history of New Zealand.
I felt such rage that part of the way they designed this horrific attack was to try and get people to react violently.
Hear my conversation with Jacinda Ardern now by searching for Conversations on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
It was a humid Sunday in December 1967 and Harold Holt, the 17th Prime Minister of Australia, was standing on Cheviot Beach, the midday sun beating down upon him. His neighbour and the woman he's having an affair with, Marjorie Gillespie, watched as Harry changed into his swim trunks. Marjorie was not interested in joining him, the water looking a little rough. But Harold claimed to know this beach like the back of his hand. He'd spearfished in it many times. Harold confidently swam out. Then a colossal wave came up and he went under. He was never seen again. Hello, I'm Lee Boucher.
And I'm Alicia Simmons, and this is The Dead Can't Sue.
We're a couple of very serious historians who, once a week, get to let loose in an ABC studio gossiping about the dead because, as far as we know, they can't sue. This week, Alicia, I've begun with the beach and the drowning because it's what Harold Holt is best remembered for. It's a mystery and a tragedy that decades later I think has kind of been reduced to memes, conspiracy theories and maybe a few jokes. It doesn't help that in Melbourne there's that swimming pool named in his honour. Yes, it's called the Harold Holt Memorial Swimming Centre.
Oh, that's just wrong, isn't it? It's like he's become sort of more of a punchline than an actual person, you know, like remembered more for his death than his life.
Yeah. You know? Honestly, I think his disappearance and death are probably the least interesting things about his life, unsurprisingly, actually. Mm-hmm. I want to argue that Harold is a bridge between a conservative mid-20th century Australia and what we understand as the kind of modernising tumult and excitement of the 1970s, the period right after his death. He was a charismatic politician who caught the imagination of Australians, and his life and political history reveals, I think really interestingly, that the Liberal Party that Harold Holt led when he became Prime Minister was a very different beast to the party of Angus Taylor and Tony Abbott, which I think is helpful for us to remember today.
Less a beast at all.
Yes, exactly, you know? And more a kind of capacious political philosophy that could house a bit of difference within it. Plus, he had kind of an interesting and kind of complex relationship with his wife, Zara. His first two kids were born to Zara while she was married to someone else.
Swinging 60s.
Exactly.
Fun.
Don't get me started. Once again, I'm obsessed on his complex relationship with his father.
Oh, I do like that, Lee. I mean, I just think that all good history is really psychoanalysis in disguise in some ways. And, you know, there's nothing better than some interesting family dynamics. So let's get into it. Tell me about young Harold. Did he have a typical Liberal politician's upbringing? I'm thinking, imagining private schools and then studying law, probably going to entering a barrister's chambers at some point.
Look,
a trip to the UK.
He ticks off some of those boxes, but not all of them.
Right.
And his access to that world is a little bit precarious. So let me explain. So he's born in 1908 in Sydney. His father, Tom, is a school teacher, so he's not from privilege.
Yeah.
And his father ends up kind of working, sort of dabbling in owning and running some pubs and becoming eventually a travelling theatrical manager.
Oh, wow, that sounds stable.
Yeah. And that's actually probably the recurring motif in biographers when they talk about Harold's early life, that it's not settled, it's not stable, it's a little bit precarious. When his parents go to Adelaide to try running a pub, he's left behind in Sydney with his brother Cliff.
Oh.
They go to something like three or four different state schools in about 5 years, and notice they're going to state schools. So, again, this is not the typical Liberal Party Prime Minister coming from privilege going to private schools necessarily that we might imagine. I suspect it's that experience of kind of moving around different primary schools that sort of hones his early skills as a bit of a charmer, which is going to be a bit of a theme through today's episode. So when his dad moves into theatre management, the Holt's financial position actually starts to improve a little bit, which also coincides with the parents' divorce, which is a really interesting, it's very hard to get a handle on their relationship. There's not a lot written about it. The mother kind of comes in and out of the story in ways that I haven't really been able to kind of get a firm grip on, I must say.
Sure. And this is, can I just ask, this is the 1920s?
Yes, that's right.
Is it? And so getting a divorce then would have actually still been quite scandalous.
Yeah, it's like, a big deal.
There's a stigma still attached to that.
And I wonder if that's partly the reason why Harry asks his father to enrol the boys at Wesley in Melbourne. He meets a boy from Wesley, is impressed by this Wesley boy and says to his dad, can you send us here? His dad's going to go to London. He knows his dad's going to go to London. He knows his dad's going to enrol him in a private school, he and his brother, and he says, can you send us to Wesley?
Far, far away.
Yeah, so
but
he takes himself out of Sydney.
Very expensive.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite a posh school, Wesley.
Yeah.
I mean, how is a former school teacher, I understand he's come into some money,
yeah,
but is he a scholarship student?
Not
or?
At Wesley, no, no. So his father's... The pub has made some money, basically.
Right. Yeah.
Biographers talk about him finding kind of solace and security at this school. He thrives there, actually.
Interesting. So lacking the kind of solid parental family structure, he instead turns to the institution and finds a home.
Yeah, and Wesley is a private school that emphasises kind of community service and has an ideal of what it calls practical divinity.
Ooh.
So it's a very community-minded, connected kind of school, and kind of Harry basically, it seems, thrives in the senior school of Wesley.
Perfect training for a future politician.
Exactly, exactly. So he's smart.
Yep.
He's also into sports and theatre. And he's not the brightest school. He's not the ducks of the school. He's very academically capable. But he's a bit of an all-rounder. And his nickname at school is, wait for it, Puss.
No one gets that nickname now, Lee.
Obvious reasons. They're calling him Puss because he has the charm of a cat.
Oh.
So, you know, imagine a young 14-year-old who's charming, a little bit feline, seducing people in the way that a cat seduces people with their charm. That's my impression of young Harry.
It's quite effeminised
as a
term as well. Is he pretty and ornamental? Is that a part of it?
Well, he's definitely becoming handsome. Biographers write about him becoming, you know, most handsome when he's goes to university a few years later, but he's clearly a very nice-looking young man. And look, I've got to say, I was a bit triggered reading about young Harry. He's like the popular, smart enough boy who gets his own, like everyone loves him. Everyone just seems to love him.
Boring.
And it's a little bit, I think, of kind of pretty privilege, right? Mm. He's pretty privileged. He's charming. He's doing well in the school. And his biographers, you know, they talk a lot in this period about him desperate for security and they feel really sorry for him. And I kind of get that. But at the same time, from the outside, he looks like he's having a pretty good time.
Sure. But lacking the family structure to fall back on.
Exactly.
He has to make it work.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So it sounds like what? He's a jock and he's also clever and he's good looking.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So he's got
it all.
He's got it all, or he needs it all, actually, in his kind of, I don't want to say precarious, but he doesn't have family security behind him, like a lot of the boys at Wesley would have. A lot of those boys at Wesley would have come from very wealthy Melbourne families. He is not from that world.
And you can imagine the day-to-day realities of that. Like if his father is overseas or otherwise travelling, that would mean awards nights, things like that. Harry looks out and he doesn't see any family members there.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
So he lands a scholarship to the University of Melbourne.
Yeah.
50% of the scholarship is for character and athleticism.
Oh, embarrassing.
Yep. So he's not, you know, he's not there on academic merit alone. Pick the nerds. He's still, you know, he goes off to Queen's College at the Uni of Melbourne. He's still super into sports. But there's the seeds of his political life beginning to be planted here.
Oh.
He's studying law. He's a member of the debating team. He wins a college medal for oratory. So he's kind of the little elements that we might say make a political leader are starting to be put in place, most notably with his roommate, which is actually his former school friend, actually, Johnny Bust. Harold's first introduction to what we might call formal political campaigning is as Bust's right-hand man when John campaigned for 2 years to get a toilet installed on the second floor of Queen's College. That toilet, eventually installed, is now known as the John Bust Memorial Lavatory.
Oh, wow. The hard political issues of his time.
Exactly.
Good on him. I love this. At the moment where, like, what, people are talking about Australia as the workers' paradise. Yeah. You have the beginnings of the Labor movement. We have Harold Holt instead campaigning for a loo.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yeah, at Queen's College.
Yes.
He's also clearly becoming, I think, aware of his capacities as a bit of a leader. He's elected president of various sports and social clubs and also the Melbourne Uni Law Students Society. So it's at uni that Harry meets Zara Dickens. She's the daughter of a wealthy businessman with great energy and style.
As someone called Zara would be.
And I've got to say,
it's a posh name.
She gets described as a bon vivant. I'm kind of a bit obsessed with her. So let me describe how they meet. Mm-hmm. And note, Zara, she's the daughter of a wealthy businessman. She's from exactly that Wesley world of privilege and security.
Right.
That he is only precariously accessing.
So their relationship would consolidate that
yes,
for them.
Yes, but also that inequity of position and inequity of security is going to come to characterise the next couple of years of their courtship. Mm-hmm. But let me describe how they meet. Harry's in first year. One of his school friends is picking him up to go off to one of those endless first year parties that we all can remember ourselves from our uni days. Harry's surprised to discover when he gets picked up, there's two young women in the car. He thought he was just getting picked up by his male friend. He gets picked up in this tiny car and there's two girls in the car, one of whom is the driver's girlfriend, Zara.
Oh.
So the first time he meets Zara, she's already in a relationship with someone else.
So hang on, sorry, can we just go back to the car? So he jumps into the back seat with her and they're jolting along together.
Electric sparks start to fly. Zara's wearing the top hat of her boyfriend, the driver.
Oh, that's sexy.
Yeah, it's kind of hot.
I like that.
Right?
It's very Marlene Dietrich, isn't it?
And by the end of the night, she's given her boyfriend back his top hat and taken Harry's instead.
Really? Is it true?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Well, is it true? As far as I know, it's true. And even if it's not true, it's true in spirit.
Exactly.
It tells us something about that encounter, right? So Harry's already considering by this point a life in politics, and he and Zara spend a lot of time talking about politics, about government. So this is the 1920s. Both of them have had World War I in living memory. Both of them have seen kind of a world being remade by the booms and busts of capitalism in a broad sense. And Zara, her response to that is to argue that government should step in and provide base-level support to those in need. But Harry thinks this sounds like socialism. Right?
Boogie boogie.
Yeah, so he's still a Wesley boy, right? He's already what we would call a liberal in the sense that it is up to the individual to work harder to ameliorate the conditions of their life.
Although maybe they do actually end up coming around to a lot of those crazy ideas, like the idea that, you know, the government should actually be there for the vulnerable, the needy, the weak, the dependent.
Spoiler alert, there's a royal commission on what's called child endowment in 1927. He's arguing essentially with Zara that the idea of a child endowment is a bad idea. He will later become the minister responsible for its implementation. So he, in fact, changes his own mind.
Unless Zara convinced him.
Well, I don't like to say, but this is me giving Zara too much agency, I think. So Zara describes their early relationship as full of jealousies and arguments, quarrelling, and I'm quoting from her here. They're quarrelling, passionate. There's a deep affection and clashing of wills.
Well, fabulous. I'm still imagining her in top hat, by the way.
Yeah, nice. Sticks with that image, although she's going to pull a move in a second anyway, we'll wait for the move. She notes that they had completely different personalities and outlooks. Those are her words. Harry's very organised and strong-minded, tidy and hardworking, while I was vague, dreamy, always running behind time and away with the pixies.
Oh, so much fun, Zara.
Yeah, and also she can afford to be away with the pixies.
Of course, of course.
She's not a scholarship student who has to think about, okay, what am I going to be doing in 3 years? She's the daughter of a wealthy businessman. Their outlooks on life are quite different. Mm-hmm. She can afford to be a little bit away with the Pixies, I think. They're dating for a little bit. It's a little bit on and off. It's a little bit uni romance. They do plan to marry, and then Zara comes into some money after an early venture into fashion business. And that produces what she describes as a violent row, where he calls off the wedding because he can't match her in terms of income and assets, and says, until I can support you, we can't get married.
Okay, so that reads to me like quite clearly a huge threat to his masculinity, in a way that is actually understandable at the time, in that masculinity is defined in legislation at this time. If you think about the Harvester judgment, it's defined there as your capacity, or the capacity of a breadwinner man to support a wife and three children, and your wage is premised on that.
Yep.
So it comes to be defined around this. So I could see, I mean, I don't forgive him for it, but I could see why he would be threatened by that.
And he's 21.
In that context.
And he's 21, right? So just remember, he's 21, 22.
Sure.
So I probably said some stuff when I was 21 and 22 that didn't have the best gender politics. Like,
oh, I didn't.
No, you've been perfect from the start.
Very right on.
So she basically says, stuff you. Yeah. Okay, and she uses that money to go on a cruise where she meets a handsome British colonial officer from India who she falls for, marries, and then goes off to India to be his wife.
Wow, that's more befitting a Zara.
Yeah, it is. So Holt says he's devastated.
Yeah.
I think he is upset in this moment where he loses Zara, but he's also got his own irons in the fire. He's already, in fact, starting to have a little fling with a girl named Lola Thring.
Is that real? Did you make that name up?
No, but I've been looking forward to saying it.
Did you get it from a Nabokov novel?
Well, speaking of Nabokov, speaking of inappropriate erotic attachments,
right?
A short while later, his dad, Harry's dad, who's come back from London, marries Lola.
No.
So just to reiterate, Harry's dad marries Harry's girlfriend.
What kind of warped, inverted Oedipal complex is this? I mean, how do we read it? Do we read it as Harry's on the cusp of manhood and the father comes in to emasculate him?
Yep.
I'm just paging Dr. Freud, as we often do throughout this podcast.
Yep.
Or how else do you see it? I mean,
she is an historical agent in this dynamic. And a little bit of me chafes just ever so slightly at the way in which Harry gets to be the victim of this dynamic because Lola was his to begin with.
So there's a kind of proprietal claim that his masculinity is premised upon over women.
Yep.
Absolutely. And the father usurping that becomes a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that.
So he's got all these proprietal claims to sort of manly competence and manly possession. And this period of life is written up as, like, you know, struggling with Zara, who chooses another man, struggling because Lola marries his dad. Still weird.
Still a bit weird.
But there is a proprietor. It's exactly right. There is a sort of a kind of implicit, I guess, licensing of his possession.
Oh, God, we could talk about Lola Thring for a long time, but tell me, how does Harry end up in Parliament?
Right. So he graduates from Melbourne University in 1930, which is a bad time to be on the job market. Depression.
Yeah.
He planned on becoming a barrister but works a bit thin on the ground. He joins the Young Nationalists, which is a kind of conservative nationalist party in 1934. He's 26 at that point, and he runs that year for a seat in the lower house in federal parliament for the United Australia Party.
So I'm assuming this is not Clive Palmer.
No. Well,
tell me about politics at that time.
Yeah. So I think one of the things to think about politics in Australia in the first three, four decades of the 20th century is the stabilising force is the ALP. The Labor Party is the stabilising force against which other parties are forming and reforming, right? So what we now call the Liberal Party does not exist yet. There are precursors to it in terms of liberalism, in terms of nationalism, but there's no coherent counterpoint to the Labor Party. It comes and goes, and the UAP is a sort of one of these kind of endless different parties that emerge to try and counterbalance the Labor Party in Australian life.
So the Liberal Party of today traces its origins to the UAP.
Yes, yes. Yeah. They would draw a lineage there.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things to note about it is that it's an intentionally nationalist party, very attached to Australia's place in the British Empire, actually as are most forms of politics at that point. So he loses his first campaign for federal parliament. He's running in a safe Labor seat. It's actually the classic story. This still exists today. You go and run in a guaranteed to lose seat, prove your worth and merit, and then get given a safe seat.
Cut your teeth.
Yeah, cut your teeth as a loser, basically. Mm-hmm. So he cuts his teeth as a loser twice, and then is elected in a by-election in a safe United Australia Party seat in 1935 when he's 27.
Oh, my God. Okay, so by today's standards, that seems absurdly young, and I cannot imagine an electorate trusting a 27-year-old. Is this normal at the time?
No, absolutely
right.
not.
Right.
Paying parliaments a full-time salary is only at that point about 10 years old. So the idea that you could become a kind of federal politician as a career is relatively new, in fact, and his particularity and peculiarity is often remarked upon. He's described as a new member who's got a dashing figure. Like, his body's constantly talked about. He's talked about as young and handsome. So he sticks out in this federal parliament. And his first speech, his main speech, nicely captures his politics. He focuses on youth unemployment, the importance of physical fitness for military recruitment, and he claims that young educated men, who is the constituency he's saying that he speaks for, note he's 27, he's saying I speak for young 27-year-old men, he claims that these men don't want to break with empire, Australia's got a duty to stand by Britain at all times, and he thought that unemployed men should be forced into work and technical training so they might learn industrious habits.
That's a moralist.
Yeah,
interesting.
And he's got no truck with a kind of socialist or left reading that the Depression might have been structural. He thinks the answer to these kind of problems is disciplining the bodies and minds of these young men into being capable individuals who will go and get jobs and look after themselves. But he's not an ideological firebrand. And one of the things I think we need to remember, he's 27. Like, he's 27, he's making a main speech in Parliament, and we're trying to pin down his politics. Like, I would be horrified to think of what politics I espoused at 27 and the way, you know, what we can see over his life is that he changes his mind. He changes his mind about all kinds of things, his politics, his ideas develop. But there is a sort of persistent, one, rejection of socialism, you know, or at least that's what he says. And two, his rejection of socialism is based on the idea that the individual man should be responsible for himself and his family.
And surely that is also because he himself has felt like he has had to be individually responsible for his own destiny.
Yes, indeed. And he's pulled it off.
Mm. So why can't everybody else?
Yeah.
Well, maybe we're not all as hot as you, Harold.
Maybe we don't
handsome
all have,
Harry.
Maybe we don't all have pretty privilege and are good at cricket.
So unfair. Okay, continue.
So, Harry, as you can probably imagine, actually, he thrives in Canberra because Canberra in
it's
the...
boring.
Don't bag Canberra. I love Canberra. Maybe I'm
boring too.
I don't know. But Harry loves Canberra because, well, let's just set the scene. It's the mid-1930s. Canberra has about 10,000 people in it.
Right.
It's a mixture of little hubs and paddocks and, you know, hotels.
Oh, it's kind
of
lovely.
It's kind of, something to it. But it's also a little bit like boarding school.
Aha.
Right? It's a city mostly of men who come there for specific periods of time and then leave. And, of course, that's the environment Harry's grown up in and thrives in as a charmer.
Sure.
He fucking loves it.
Although, doesn't he also love the ladies? We're going to get to that later,
Yes, yes, he does.
Tune in for episode two.
And he's described at the time in the press as the Parliament's most eligible bachelor.
Hot.
Yeah, and I think it's both interesting that he's described that way. What I find equally interesting is that he clearly likes it.
Yeah, interesting.
He's proffering himself up, or people are asking him to present his body, his personality, his identity for consumption as an object of desire, as an object of interest, and he's making his way in a political world being comfortable with that.
It's also interesting because this is the high point of eugenics, yep. you know, in Australia. And I'm just thinking about the art of this period. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those images of beautiful, muscular, male, tanned bodies on the beach throwing beach balls, you know, it's... All right, I'll just stop there.
Sorry, just got carried away.
We'll leave that for later on tonight.
No, but I think you're right. I think Harry's politics.
There's a eugenicist element
to him. Harry's politics, Harry's political framework resonates with exactly the kind of ideas and ideals of healthy white bodies possessing and taking over this country, right?
The new nation.
And being the centre of its political life, and that muscular vitality is a sign of moral virtue.
It's a muscular Christianity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, those ideas have been around for a little while, and he's the latest version of them in some ways. Okay, so in 1939, Harry becomes a government minister in the first government of Robert Menzies, making him the youngest man ever to hold ministerial office in Parliament. He's not on the front bench for long because in 1940, remember, the war's broken out in 39, earlier in Asia. He enlisted in the Australian Imperial Force to fight the war. That doesn't last long either. It's actually a little talked about episode in Australian political history when the Menzies government loses three senior ministers in an air crash.
God, that's awful.
Yeah, it's
in the same plane.
It's our Buddy Holly moment.
Yeah, it really is.
In terms of federal politics.
Yeah.
And Holt gets recalled to camp. So he thinks he's going to go off and fight and then doesn't.
Because he wants to fight too, doesn't he? He's a real nationalist.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And he's then given the Labor and National Service portfolio, where he introduces, I think, the thing I've become most fascinated with in Harry's early life anyway, which is that he introduces or is the face of child endowment, which basically is the government giving mothers specifically 5 shillings a week for every child except their first child.
So it's a universal, non-means-tested form of financial assistance, which we today would probably dismiss as a kind of baby bonus, right? Like that's how we understand
it. Yeah, and it is a little bit of a baby bonus. Harry has been worried about declining birth rates, right? So exactly that classic fear about a declining population, meaning that you pay mothers to have children, essentially, or support mothers to have children, depending on how you frame it. This is the Australia of the White Australia policy. There's a tremendous anxiety about making sure this continent is filled with white babies. So paying people to supporting mothers to have children is partly a kind of racial politics at this point in time. At the same time, though, this has been a piece of social security, what we would call social security legislation, that feminists in Australia have been campaigning for 40 years at this point.
Yeah, campaigning for alongside a whole range of other, what a historian Marilyn Lake calls maternalist politics.
Yeah.
And I find it really interesting because it is one of those things that you could so easily dismiss, and yet really when we're talking about Australia's, the history of Australian welfare, you track it back to this period and to these efforts on the part of feminists to intercede in many ways, between them and their husbands to kind of say, and it's a protectionist politics. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not fighting for freedom. What they're fighting for or what they're saying is they're drawing upon that 19th century language of protection. They're saying, you know, in the same ways in the 19th century you had this idea that men were the protectors of a very vulnerable kind of, you know, form of femininity. They say, sure, the problem is, though, they've done a really bad job of it. You know, far from protecting us, they've ended up being our predators, you know, in many ways. And to this extent, we need, at those moments when we are most vulnerable, which is when you've given birth and or you've got children, we need to institute a separation between wifedom and motherdom, you know, or motherhood, you know, so that you don't have women dependent upon their husbands in those moments. So I look, and it's one of those things that they introduce alongside a range of other, you know, welfare reforms at that stage. And what I love about this kind of period is actually it shows how much feminists were interested in social welfare and actually created the state that we have, welfare state that we have today.
Yeah. What's amazing, that's probably putting it too generously, but what's interesting here is that it's not means tested.
Yeah.
It's not restricted by race. It is available, and there's no sense of mothers having to perform duties in particular kinds of ways to get it, which is quite...
It's universal.
Yeah, it's universal, which is quite a kind of radical intervention. And some historians of the left would say the reason Harold Holt puts this up is because there's contest over the basic wage going on, and this is a sop to the Labor Party to try and get them to stop campaigning for an increase in wages. So this promising parliamentary career is brought to an abrupt interruption when Menzies is first rolled as PM and then loses, and then the UAP loses the next election in 1941 and the ALP is elected, and then the governments of Chifley and Curtin follow.
Right.
It's not until Menzies is re-elected in 1949 that Holt is back in the corridors of power, back being a government minister, and he is given by Robert Menzies probably two of the thorniest issues of the 1950s, which is immigration and industrial relations.
So with the first, you're looking at the White Australia policy, obviously, and from what I understand of Harold Holt, it's that he starts to modernise in some ways. He actually starts to shift, you know, or to roll it back, to unpick it in some ways. He shifts the focus to Asia. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, you start to see the seeds of that mode of thinking, which really shape his prime ministership when he is the immigration minister.
Right.
So he picks away at the edges of the White Australia policy. He's quite, loosening up some of the racialised restrictions that characterise migration and also characterise access to citizenship for migrants.
He sounds like a wet lib.
Yeah.
Is he for this, or is this just the Liberal Party at the time? Like, is he on the left of it?
No, and he's definitely on the, wet or softer side of this. And I think we also need to remember that in terms of racial politics in Australia, it is the Australian Labor Party.
Oh, yeah, who are the... Yeah, fuck
they are much more firmly attached to the notion of white Australia on the basis of protecting the rights of white workers.
Yeah.
So there's a bit more space for Liberals, broadly conceived, to loosen up some of their thinking here. But, you know, he doesn't have exactly the same politics as Menzies. He plays along with the Menzies government's broad positions on these kinds of things.
Because Menzies is British to the bootstraps,
exactly,
right?
Yeah. So he's also Minister for Industrial Relations in this period. Again, a conciliatory kind of figure. He has a great relationship with the head of the ACTU, quite unusual for a Liberal politician.
Mm.
You know, there is some very big industrial conflict in the 50s, don't get me wrong. He threatens to bring in the army. He threatens to break strikes on the wharves. Like, he's not like a softy, lovely accord politics guy of the 80s. He's definitely still Liberal. He's definitely still deeply suspicious of union power and particularly of communist influence in the unions, but he is most interested in finding ways to agree. And so he works really closely with his counterpart in the ACTU and says basically funnel all union activities and negotiations through a central figure so that I can talk directly to them and we will figure out a way through these industrial conflicts. And strike rates gradually go down over the course of the decade. So I think both left and right political historians don't love him, but I think that's because he's trying to beat a kind of middle-ish path through these two different ways of understanding Australian
and
industrial relations.
And that sort of seems to chime in with his personality as well. Like he's someone who's sort of beloved by all.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So he then becomes treasurer, which is a massive fail. He's terrible at it. Yeah, he's obviously not economically minded. I have deep sympathy. Yeah. No one should.
I'm basically a numerous.
Yeah, no one should look at my budget. He makes a few big errors of judgment as treasurer. Menzies has to step in and overturn one of his policies. It's quite a humiliating kind of experience for him. And there's some really big question time gaffes. So when he's trying to explain budgets, explain tariff policy on the floor of Parliament, he looks a bit incompetent. So he's been very competent as immigration and industrial relations minister, and then he steps up to become treasurer and it's a bit of a face plant.
Right.
but it's lucky he's face planting but he has Zara by his side to make him feel better.
Zara? When did she come back from India?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
I thought she was still on top of an elephant somewhere.
I was saving this one. So actually she's been there the whole time. I was kind of keeping her quiet off the side. So back in 1938, Zara had returned to Australia and kicked things off again with Harry. She's still married to someone else, to her first husband. She had twin boys in 1939, and a later biographer reveals that they're actually Harry's children. So she has children to Harry while married to someone else, and that's revealed in 2005, although widely understood in their world and actually in the Canberra political bubble. One of the kids looks really like Harry. It's kind of...
quite good looking.
Yeah. So a big part of the Harold Holt story, I think, is that he has two children with somebody else's wife, then marries her and she's divorced, and nobody reports on any questions about their relationship, any questions about their children. There is an agreement from the Australian press that they do not report or intervene on the scandalous lives of Australian politicians, or at least on the lives of men. And Harold is able to make his way in Parliament because everyone agrees not to talk about it. So the next couple of years they're carrying on together. By the early 40s, she's secured a divorce. And in 1946, when Harold's dad dies, father disappears, he then marries Zara, they kind of, when they get married, Harry says to her, just know you will always come second to my political career.
Oh, that's romantic. Did he write that in a card?
Yeah.
That's really nice.
I kind of love the upfrontery of it. This is what you're signing up for. You know, I'm a politician. You are signing up to be a political wife.
But it sounds like she's got her own thing going on anyway with her clothing.
Yeah. So there's something really interesting revealed about Harry in this moment where they get married, aside from his... rather unromantic declaration of her coming second to his political career, which is that he's shocked to discover when Zara's setting up the house in Melbourne that she's going to have to go and buy bed linen. He says, I thought houses came with all these things when you bought them.
Oh, wow.
Which tells us, I think, a lot about his upbringing. He's been in institutions where the labour of making beds, of buying bed linen, of cooking has been done by somebody else. He's never really had to think about how houses get run. And all of a sudden he's married and Zara's like, okay, so I'm going to run our house. And he's like, has just no concept of how any of that works.
Such a boarding school kid, isn't
he? He's such a boarding school kid.
It's also funny that he then, you know, orchestrates the child endowment.
Yeah.
you know, kind of thing, which suggests a kind of knowledge and affinity of the labour of care that women are doing at that time.
Well, I think when we put those two things together, what we realise maybe is that he's the face of child endowment, but not its author.
Oh, absolutely. It's the feminists who are arguing for
that. Yeah, yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. So, but when they get back together, they are a very successful political couple. They're travelling a lot, going overseas. They're having a pretty good time. She's got quite a successful career as a designer and an owner of a chain of dress shops, not the Zara we know today. She's got her own thing going on. She's charming, funny, entertaining, charismatic. They're a bit of a power couple.
Kind of Bill and Hillary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With similarly juicy...
Loosey-goosey.
Loosey-goosey kind of sexual relationships, which she'll get to in the next episode. But they also travel, and this is, you know, a bit of a little factoid about his life I find really fascinating. They go every year to northern Queensland where they have a holiday house in Bingle Bay, which they can only afford because of Zara's financial success, just
probably
FYI.
He like had fights with her about that when she first announced it.
Like, dude, you're going to get a holiday house in North Queensland. Calm down. they're spending time up there because Harold's old friend, the artist and environmentalist John Bust, is there.
He's been there the whole way through.
Yeah. So he's got these school friends, and this is one of them. And John Bust is a kind of one of the figures of Australian history who brings the idea of the rainforest into many white people's consciousness, and we'll get a little bit more into this next week. But they go up to their holiday house here, and this is where Harry's love of the water is really is really clear. He gets into the ocean.
Oh, no.
He gets
you
into the ocean.
You know how that ends.
Yeah, at every available opportunity. On more than one occasion, Zara and John are screaming at him to get back in the boat because there's sharks around. And he's like, I'm fine, I'm fine. So he's got a little, you know what? He's a little cocky.
Yeah.
Right?
Showing off, absolutely.
And he thinks that when he's in the water, he's going to be able to handle whatever threats the ocean throws his
way. The other thing that I've heard about Harold is that he's not actually that great a swimmer.
No.
He's not a particularly strong swimmer.
No.
He's a good diver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe when you're in the calm waters of northern Queensland, spearfishing in the reef, you know, that's fine. But in off Cheviot Beach and those waves, he's going to run afoul. We'll get to that later.
A clap of thunder sounds in the distance. Hark!
While we do all know the ending that I'm gesturing towards there, mm-hmm. I think there's much more to say about his prime ministership, about his affairs, about his hubris, and what he did achieve, I think, as one of Australia's shortest serving prime ministers, who oversaw some incredible changes in policy, White Australia policy, 1967 referendum, as well as saving a big chunk of that rainforest where he spent so much time every year with Johnny and his wife, Zara. But Alicia, for now, it's been a joy gossiping about Harold Holt with you.
It's been a delight, Lee.
If you know someone who loves history or gossip, or just two historians letting loose in an ABC studio, share The Dead Can't Sue with them. Go on.
If you have some juicy gossip about someone dearly departed, or just someone you'd like us to dig up the dirt on, then send an email to thedeadcan'tsue@abc.net.au.
The Dead Can't Sue is an ABC Audio Studios podcast made on the land of the Kulin Nation and on Gadigal Country.
It's produced by Hannah Jose, video producer Christian Harimano, supervising producer Hannah Riesch, and executive producer Claire Rawlinson. We've chucked a bunch of links to our sources in the show notes, so go on, do some further reading if you'd like. We dare you.
I'm Lee Boucher, Associate Professor at Macquarie University.
I'm Alicia Simmons, Associate Professor of Law at UTS.
And we can't wait to gossip about the dead again with you next week.